Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line. It is Tuesday, 1 week and 1 day away from the debate with Bart Ehrman in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And that means, actually, for me, it's actually just a few days before I fly out, because I will have the privilege of ministering at Tom Askell's church in Florida this coming Sunday, and then heading to Fort Lauderdale from there. It's sort of, I confess I don't know Florida geography very well, even though I've been there a number of times. For me, it's really hard to figure out a state where there are no mountains to look at. So everything looks the same. There's a mountain over there. No, there's not a mountain over there. But anyway, we're going to be going from one place to another. And so I'm going to be heading out earlier and therefore have less time than it might appear to finish up the presentation. I'm working on doing that until just a few moments ago, literally about 5 minutes before the program came in here. And as a result, I forgot to grab the URL to a thread at Catholic Answers I was going to mention just briefly. It was some comments by Phil Porvoznik. Now, Phil Porvoznik is a part-time sort of wannabe Roman Catholic apologist who will never pick up the phone and call this program and make his claims, because he knows that he would get turned inside out and wouldn't be able to answer questions. But he's very brave behind a keyboard and tries to use humor to sort of cover the fact that he really can't handle what he's talking about. But he was commenting on the 33,000 denominations issue. And it is truly amazing. There is no end to what the human mind can do to continue to believe a lie, even as long as you want to believe the lie. As long as you want to believe it, you will find a way to continue to believe it. That's just all there is to it. And that's exactly what Phil Porvoznik has done. So what he does is he just ignores entire swaths of the information. He ignores the context. He ignores, the Steve Ray has said these are Protestant denominations, these are just sola scriptura, that these include, just the most wild group of groups you can put together, including Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and Oneness Pentecostals. And this is all due to sola scriptura, right? Ignores all that and says, well, it's about 98% non-Catholic. As if that's somehow relevant to rescuing himself and rescuing the Roman Catholics, who have just simply lied to us for so many years about that particular source. You cannot make a person honest. You cannot make a person love the truth. You cannot make a person reason rationally in any way, shape, or form. As long as they want to believe something, they'll keep believing it. And that's what you see going on over on the Catholic Answers board. Meanwhile, I posted a... I just realized now, I don't think I blogged it. Oops. Well, I'll get up there eventually. I will try to blog here fairly soon. Video that I put up. Did I blog the video with Sam Gipp? I know I uploaded it to the site, but I'm sitting here going, did I blog that? I don't think I did. I'll check. But I put up a video. Sam Gipp had... Sam Gipp, Sam Gipp, and he's King James only Ruckmanite, and he put up a video calling me a liar and saying I'm lying about the Ankerberg stuff. The funny thing is, it's very, very clear from listening to him talk, he hasn't even kept up with the developments on that subject over the years. He doesn't recognize that the VHS copy that the Ankerberg Ministry had initially put out, and which was put on the air, eventually did not have the Wilkin incident in it, and then they reinserted it later, took out a long answer I gave to make room for it, so that they could provide the actual video of what took place. There was only one incident took place. Sam Gipp's memory is just wrong. And you've got to choose whether you're going to believe me or Sam Gipp. But I've told the same story from the beginning. There is an article on in our King James Only section of website. It's been up there since either 95, 96, 97, somewhere around there. It's been up there for over a decade, telling the same story. And when that video finally was provided by Anchor Bird, guess what? It's exactly what I said it was. Same spot, same question, everything exactly as I described it. Or you can accept Sam Gipp's word, except he doesn't have any video and doesn't have stuff that was written over a decade ago demonstrating that he was telling the same story. So you just sort of have to decide from there. But it was interesting. I didn't mention this in video, but at one point in the video, he says that I can shave my head and grow facial hair all I want so I don't look like the guy on the Ankerberg show. I think... he actually thinks that he said later on, I have nothing better to be doing anyways, which is, I just follow Sam Gipp around after he debates, Bart Ehrman and Muslims in London and, John Dominic Crossan and John Shelby Spong, I got nothing better to do than just follow after him. But anyways, evidently he really thinks that I changed my entire look just simply so I wouldn't look like the person in the Ankerberg show. Actually, the reality of that is once age started catching up to me and I started looking like I was trying out for the part of Martin Luther after the tonsor cut, I decided to dump that real quick. So I tell you. Anyway, so I put the documentation back up there. And if I forgot to blog it, I'll get it. It's not up there? Yeah, okay. Sometimes when I get up onto YouTube, it's like, okay, it's there, it's great, and I forget to grab the embedding code and get it in the blog. So we'll take care of that. Anyway, yeah, someone just mentioned in channel, I would really, really not want to see Bart Ehrman go up against Sam Gipp. That would be, that'd be bad. Given how badly the King James Only guys did on the Ankerberg show, and that was with Christians. it would be, anyway. So I'm definitely looking forward to next week. I would like to thank all of those who made it possible for Alan Kirshner to go to Florida. It's going to be nice to have Alan along. He's one of the blog team on the team Apologion. But even more so, as you may recall, Alan was on with me a few months ago, and we talked about Luke 23:34, and we discussed the textual variant there. And he has been for a number of years now a student at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. He studied textual criticism under Eldon Epp. And so he knows the Epp, Ehrman, Parker triumvirate of modern textual critical scholars who really are moving textual criticism away from its historical underpinnings, that of establishing the original text of the New Testament, to where now the focus is on the actual variants themselves and the story that each manuscript can tell. And unfortunately, a lot of folks don't realize that that's what's going on, and it is. And I'll probably come out some next week. I don't know. This is such a large field, and there's so many facts and figures to be thrown into it that I want to warn those who will be in attendance ahead of time. This will be a scholarly debate, and I fully intend to be displaying manuscripts and variants and utilizing technical language, because you're going to have the opportunity of then taking that material and listening to it again. I will have, of course, a keynote presentation to be made so that it'll be a little bit easier to follow. I think I've shown some of the illustrations. I put one of the graphics an early edition of one of the graphics on the blog yesterday. Made some changes to that already. Some of you even saw there was a textual variant in my graphic, which I found rather interesting. And it was inadvertent on my part initially, but the funny thing is it matches the exact text of Codex Sinaiticus. I'll talk about that sometime when we have more time to talk about it. But anyway, I'm going to be illustrating these things And someone needs to calm that man down out there. In the studio audience, he's bouncing all over the place. When he was leaning up against the wall, the mirror was shaking and stuff like that. It's extremely distracting. So we need to calm the studio audience down out there. We let these people in out of the goodness of our hearts. They're standing out there in the cold.
You better watch it. You got two of us out here now. We're going to be fighting over who grabs the mic first.
Yes, but it still has a studio audience. Audience does imply at least one. But anyway, I'm just letting you know, Dr. Ehrman's assertions need to be challenged on a scholarly level, and we have one shot at doing this, and so we want to do so in an appropriate, scholarly, respectful fashion, and I'm really praying that that's exactly what will take place. I mentioned this on the Apologetics.com radio program that aired over the weekend, so I might as well go ahead and mention it now. It is fully my intention, and I would ask for your prayers toward the completion of this project. It is fully my intention, as a result of doing these literally months of intensive study and research into the claims that Bart Ehrman makes in regards to misquoting Jesus and the use of his material, I have been encouraged by many, and I think it is absolutely appropriate for me to take all this information, not only the textual information, the information about the manuscripts, the backgrounds, the specific variants, Mark 1:41, Hebrews 2:9, John 1:18, the texts that he has addressed. It is not only appropriate to take that information, but also his accusations concerning the Synoptic Gospels, alleged synoptic parallel issues, which, of course, are always troubling to people, and to put all of this into a single volume, a refutation of Bart Ehrman. And so that is my my intention to do so, beginning when I get back from the debate and the conference and the cruise, to begin to put that material together. And so I would ask for your prayers for that project, especially in regards to who to have publish it. I have a specific idea in mind. And hopefully they will find that that information not even close. No, Rich. No. that's something that's just really needs to be done, and I need to dive into it as soon as I get back, in the sense that it'll still be very fresh upon the mind and things like that. So I am excited about that. It's been a couple of years since I wrote a book. I have done two new editions, by the way, both Potter's Freedom. The final galleys of the Potter's Freedom, second edition, arrived yesterday, were sent to me. So that means it's going to be heading to the printer very quickly. So that should be available fairly soon. And I'm supposed to receive sometime this week. Great timing. I guess I can take them with me. I'm supposed to receive the galleys on the second edition of the King James Only Controversy as well. And I'm not sure how it's going to work, because I haven't yet worked with them in the placement of some key graphics yet. So still some work to be done there. And, of course, knowing how things work for me, they'll be calling and asking me to do that as I'm standing in line to get on the ship. that's normally how it works for me. But anyhow, given all of that, let's get back into the program that we have been reviewing. And that is the a dialogue between Bart Ehrman and Reggie Finley, I believe is the name. And he is the infidel guy. This is from October 18th, 2007. And we're going to finally get into the part here fairly quickly where I think some real interesting disagreement is going to take place. It's going to be very illustrative. So let's get back into the program here.
That seems to be important to me. The most famous story in the Gospels is probably the story of Jesus and the woman caught in the act of adultery, where Jesus has this line, let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her.
I like Monty Python's version better, but yes.
Yeah, right. Right. So the thing is, even though everybody knows the story, mm-hmm. and it's a terrific story, it wasn't originally in the Gospel of John. Or in any of the Gospels. It was added later.
And we know this because we have older manuscripts that don't have it in there.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons.
Okay.
The oldest manuscripts don't have it.
Okay.
the writing style of that story is very different from the writing style of the surrounding stories.
Wow.
There are words used in that story that occur nowhere else in the Gospel of John.
Right.
So this isn't even a debated point. I mean, I knew this when I was at the Moody Bible Institute.
Wow.
So,
did you catch that? Wow, you knew something when you were at Moody? the bias, prejudice, whatever other words you want to use here, absolutely unbelievable. But yeah, everybody knows this, and it's interesting to me. I think the strongest reason to reject John 7:53 through 8:11, which is one of the two largest textual variants in the New Testament, Mark 16:9-20, both have 12 verses. The strongest reason is not this linguistic stuff about, well, there are words here that are not used anywhere else in the Gospel of John. Well, you could take almost any section of the Gospel of John, find a unique word, and say, this can't be part of it. I just don't find that kind of argumentation compelling in almost any situation. There might be some situations when something, if the style is so completely different. I mean, if you're bopping along in John and all of a sudden you run into a chapter that sounds like it's from Hebrews, okay, with all sorts of Atticisms and stuff like that. Okay, fine. That's understandable. But something like that. That's not the strongest argumentation from my perspective at all. The strongest reason from my perspective to see John 7:53 through 8:11 as non-original is this. It is found in one manuscript after John 7:36. It's found in another manuscript, a family of manuscripts, family one, after John 21:25. And here's the kicker for me. In family 13 is a group of manuscripts. We've actually found, interestingly enough, some new members of family 13 just over the past couple of years. The Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts has found them. It occurs in Luke 21:38. The whole story in family 13 is in Luke, not in John. And in 13:33, it is found in after Luke 24:53. It is not found in P66, P75, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, etc., etc. So, but when you have a story that travels from place to place, that's generally indicative of a later accretion. And that really, to me, is the strongest evidence on that particular one. But again, as Ehrman has said many times himself, look, there's really not much new in my book. And he's right up to a point. Because this is just general knowledge. This is stuff I knew in Bible college, too. Really? Yeah. People actually learn things in Bible college. What is unusual about Bart Ehrman's book is the application that he makes. When he says, well, look, we don't know what the original was. What he means by that is not that the original doesn't exist in manuscript tradition, but that we don't know with absolute certainty. Photographic, take a video of Paul as he wrote the words certainty, which, of course, we couldn't have for anything from the ancient world, and therefore you really couldn't have anything that could meet Bart Ehrman's own standards for what is inspired or supposed to be inspired according to his theory.
You know, there's no, not really even a debate about the woman taking an adultery, but most people have never heard of it. Never heard of the fact that it wasn't original to
right,
the
Testament. Right, right. So yeah.
And what does that tell you? That tells you that most people are ignorant of the Bible, and that includes Christians. And you're sitting there saying, are you seriously suggesting that we should tell our people about things like this? I'm seriously suggesting that we should have the guts to print Bibles that don't have it in there. That's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that, Dan Wallace said at his ETS presentation back in November that the NET seriously considered not having the Pericope Adulterae, John 7:53-8:11, and the long reigning of Mark in the actual text. What they ended up doing, and I had to chuckle at this, and he got a good laugh out of it. Dan does tell good stories. Is that they put the font much smaller and put it in brackets? And he said we made it smaller so it'd be harder to read from the pulpit. So you got a good laugh out of that. But yeah, I'm saying yes, we do need to talk about these things because Bart Ehrman is. Why did his book explode like this? Well, because it's not saying anything different than what we've been saying all along, but it's who said it and then the spin he put on it to try to create unfaith, disbelief. That's why the book did what it did.
So yet again, I mean, surely, you would, I don't understand. I mean, I guess it's some compartmentalization, but I mean, if I was sitting there at the Moody Bible Institute, I guess I had to be a fundamentalist, but I mean, if I heard that, I'd go, the first thing that popped up in my head is, how many other instances are there of this?
Yeah.
That is what pops into everybody's head. That's exactly what pops into everybody's head. And that's why we have to talk about it. Because we're talking about one of two. One of two major variants. That in Mark 16, 9 through 20. Beyond that, your variants are single verses. And then there's a small number of them, and almost all of those, not including the comma Johannium, and that's barely even, that is a meaningful variant, but not a viable variant. So it doesn't even enter into the meaningful category, to be perfectly honest with you. But beyond that, the vast majority of variations are word order, phrases, words, spelling. So you're looking at the biggest thing here, and so that is why Ehrman keeps bringing these things up, is so that you have this shock value to it. That's what it's meant to do. The only way to counteract that is to take it away. Explain these things in the context of faith, rather than allowing for all these false presuppositions to just be assumed and then act upon the false presuppositions.
Oh, well, that's what got me interested in this whole thing.
Right.
And I realized, even at Moody Bible Institute, that it was a really important issue, because if you wanted to say that the words were inspired and you didn't have the words, what good does it say they were inspired? I mean, you don't have them.
Right.
So that's why I started devoting my life to looking into this.
Exactly.
And, more than 30 years later, I've changed my views about the inspiration of the text, but I haven't changed my view about the importance of looking into this kind of thing.
Right.
There again, please note that the infidel guy did not force these words out of Bart Ehrman's mouth. This is a subject he addresses freely over and over and over again. That this is why he questioned these things, because he learned these things. And what's the unspoken statement beyond that? And once you learn about these things, you should question these things too. That is the very essence.
Right. And you yourself, you're now agnostic. Correct.
I am agnostic. Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. Then that works, because the believers will still think you have a chance. They still think they have a chance of saving you.
Yeah, I think they'll have a chance.
Yeah. So at least they'll listen to you then, because at least you're agnostic now. But I was about to call it a number. I'm so used to doing that. Again, if you have any questions, type those in red, please, in the IRC room and the stick cam chat room. I know we had someone earlier type of question, but I think I just missed it. Oh, here we go. Javi's asking, do you believe in the historical Jesus? That's a good question.
Yeah, I was thinking about writing a book about this, because I get the question a lot. And I unfortunately get quoted as someone who thinks that Jesus didn't exist, which I think is really very strange, because I've written an entire book on what Jesus said and did.
Now, here's where we get into the fun part. Because quite obviously, the infidel guy is a promoter of Bob Price and all these way out in the ozone layer writers who actually promote the idea that Jesus never existed. And he's obviously had him on the program, and the infidel guy, any fact has no context. The context of all facts is to substantiate his rebellion against God and his unbelief. And so, he'll grab hold of anything. So, obviously, and you can tell this by the end of the program, obviously, he is taken aback that Bart Ehrman believes Jesus existed. He somehow assumed that if you're an atheist that you don't believe Jesus existed. And so now what is fascinating about this to me is to listen to the argumentation, because now Ehrman's going to be facing a guy who is more liberal than he is, more unbelieving than he is. What kind of arguments is he going to make to stand his ground where he is? And I think you'll find the form of argumentation to be both obvious and highly instructive. Let's listen.
Okay.
And for him to say and do anything, he had to exist. So I don't think there's any serious historian who doubts the existence of Jesus. There are a lot of people who want to write sensational books and make a lot of money who say Jesus didn't exist, but I don't know any serious scholar who doubts the existence of Jesus. And so absolutely.
Or shall we say a Jesus?
Well, I mean,
because there's some ideas about this too, right? Like, Jesus Christ itself, right, just means, what does it mean? Like, the anointed one or something?
Well, Christ is the Greek word for anointed one. It's the same, it's the Greek equivalent of the word Mashiach in Hebrew, which
Messiah.
Is where we get Messiah from.
Right. So basically, so any, you know, Jewish sect that believed that they had that Jesus Christ, then that entity would exist, so to speak. So I guess what I'm saying here, I'm going with maybe the multiple Jesus hypothesis, that there might have been a variety of different, which is why we have so many different stories.
I don't think there was more than one person. I mean, I think there was a historical person, Jesus, and that we can say some things historically about him. But what happened was, after his death, so many people told stories in so many different parts of the Roman Empire that different portraits of Jesus emerged. And some of these portraits show up in the Gospels, so that, in fact...
Now, that's not where the infidel guy is coming from, okay? Just so you know. You know, the multiple Jesus saying, well, this is just a composite story about this mythical person, that mythical person. See, and Ehrman ain't going there, because that is really way out there. I mean, when John Dominic Crossan can look at that and go, oh, that's a pretty weird idea. Where'd you get that from? Then it's pretty weird. It involves a completely biased, imbalanced historiography. There's no question about that at all. And so you can see that the infidel guy is starting to go, what? And it's going to get real interesting.
The portrait of Jesus in Luke's gospel is different from the portrait of Mark, and different from the one in John, and different from the one in the gospel of Peter, or the gospel of Judas. I mean, these are all different portraits.
Well, it sounds like to me, there are some people in the chat room right now disagreeing, of course, but they're saying that there really isn't any hardcore evidence, though, that, I mean, there isn't any you know, evidence, really, that Jesus did exist, except what people are saying about him. But
I disagree with that.
Really?
What hardcore evidence is there that Julius Caesar existed?
This is the same kind of argument apologists use, by the way, for the existence of Jesus, by the way.
Oh, no! Apologists ask the same question? No! How can this be? And of course, this is, the people in this guy's chat room are going to be your standard hardcore radical atheists who, again, have no real connection with history or anything like that at all. And so here it comes.
Yeah. They like to say the same thing you just said just then about, well, what kind of evidence we have for Jew?
It's just a typical, it's a historical point.
Right.
I mean, how do you establish the historical existence?
Right.
From the past.
I guess it depends on the claims. It depends on the claims that people have made during that particular time about a particular person and their influence on society.
One has to look at historical evidence. And if you say that historical evidence doesn't count, then I think you get into huge trouble, because then then why not just deny the Holocaust? Or, why not deny that Abraham Lincoln lived? Or why not deny, I think these things, I think it matters what happened in history.
Right. Well, what I like to say is, I like to word it this way, because, really, I think we do have more evidence for those things you mentioned than we probably do Jesus Christ. But I like to tell people, well, what harm would it do? Because especially the information that you have just now about even if there was a Jesus, the book of Mark shows us that there was an embellishment way after anyway.
Well, there are people who want to know what Jesus really did say.
Right.
And, that assumes that he really existed.
We can't know.
You have to look at the evidence.
But what is the evidence? Because even that we cannot know for sure. But I guess you would say we can look at the earliest manuscript.
Now notice what's going on here. We cannot know for sure. I don't know. I shouldn't laugh. But these radical atheists, basically, unless you have MP3 recordings, videotape from circling satellites, some kind of time machine, then nobody existed in the past. And even Ehrman's going to get somewhat frustrated and say, well, dude, we don't have that kind of evidence for anybody in the past. We're pretty sure they existed, but we don't have that kind of evidence for them. And, of course, that happens to be the case. And so we'll continue listening to this rather. And it's going to – the real interesting part's coming up here because Ehrman is going to make an argument regarding Paul. And you're going to see how this all fleshes out. But we'll continue that right after our break. We'll be right back.
A godly man, such a rarity today. So many stars, strong and true, quickly fall away.
Answering those who claim that only the King James Version is the Word of God, James White, in his book The King James Only Controversy, examines allegations that modern translators conspired to corrupt Scripture and lead believers away from true Christian faith. In a readable and responsible style, author James White traces the development of Bible translations, old and new, and investigates the differences between new versions and the authorized version of 1611. You can order your copy of James White's book, The King James Only Controversy, by going to our website at www.aomin.org.
The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture texts on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomin.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Pierce. In a day and age where the gospel is being twisted into a man-centered self-help program, the need for a no-nonsense presentation of the gospel has never been greater. I am convinced that a great many go to church every Sunday, yet they have never been confronted with their sin. Alpha and Omega Ministries is dedicated to presenting the gospel in a clear and concise manner, making no excuses. Man is sinful and God is holy. That sinful man is in need of a perfect Savior, and Jesus Christ is that perfect Savior. We are to come before the holy God with an empty hand of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Alpha and Omega takes that message to every group that we deal with, while equipping the body of Christ as well. Support Alpha and Omega Ministries and help us to reach even more with the pure message of God's glorious grace. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Dividing Line. We're listening to the infidel guy who gets on a lot of people's nerves, I've noticed. It does me, too. And it's all because it's just this breathless, anything that can lead you to unbelief. That's what drives people nuts. You know, there's not the slightest bit of discernment or understanding. It's just anything to help me unbelieve. Yes, this is wonderful. This is great. And that drives a lot of people crazy. But anyway, Gary, we'll get to you in just a moment. I've got some information for you, but I want you to hear this portion, because here it's coming up where we finally get to what happens when Bart Ehrman runs into a real atheist.
That date to what, around when he should have existed or something, or what? What do we have? Because we don't have anything that exists, right, until after he died, allegedly, right?
About him, you mean?
Right, about Jesus.
Well, that's true of everyone.
So,
well, not really. Aren't there some? I thought there was some. Well, I guess so. But I thought that there were some contemporary. That there are some writers who'd write about.
CNN was around. They maybe been recording some of those guys. Yeah, that's what I thought. Maybe
people as they existed, like with Julius Caesar, weren't
right,
there?
But Julius, we don't have. I mean, we don't have anybody from that time talking to us now. All we have are ancient records.
Right, but again,
and all we have for Jesus are ancient records.
But we don't have any ancient records of anyone who wrote about Jesus while he was alive, do we?
No, absolutely not. And we don't
that's
have
the difference.
Just
Absolutely not, which of course I would contest.
Because we don't have four billions of people who lived in the past that we're pretty sure existed.
That's true.
I mean, we have more evidence for Jesus than we have for almost anybody from his time period. So, I mean, you know, I'm not saying this as a believer. I'm not a believer. But as a historian, I'm just saying that you can't just kind of dismiss it and say, well, you know...
Now, you know what this demonstrates to me is that Ehrman has not really spent any time looking into these radical atheists. That's not his thing. He wasn't looking to become their big star. He certainly wouldn't be talking like this if he was. But can you hear in the laughter in his voice? That's what happens when you encounter a position that you just find to be so ridiculous and so beyond belief, you've never actually even formulated a response to it. You're actually trying to come up with something on the fly, and generally that's how we respond to that kind of thing.
We don't know. I mean, you have to look at the evidence. So there is hard evidence, I think.
I would look for archaeological evidence as well.
For example,
how many people exist in the past that leave archaeological evidence of their specific individual existence? I mean, it's just this kind of standard that they try to use is just so absurd. But evidently they live in their own little world and they don't recognize it.
We have one author who actually knew Jesus' relatives and knew his disciples.
And who was that?
Paul.
Did you catch that? I was interested about that. I thought he was going to say something about Luke or something like that, but Paul. Now remember, let me give you some background here. Ehrman, in the Great Courses series on the New Testament, it's a class that he videotaped, and I've listened to it a number of times, takes a position that there are only seven genuine Pauline epistles. The pastorals are out, Ephesians is out, Colossians is out. There are only seven genuine Pauline epistles. So he doesn't even take the 10, you know, just to get rid of the pastorals, certainly doesn't take the 13 view. So, keeping that in mind, that he rejects part of the Pauline corpus, he takes this seven letters position. Now, how does that work against someone who thinks no letters? I mean, you've got 13 to claim, you've got seven that you think are real, but on what basis do you defend that against someone who says none of them are Pauline? Or is it just a subjective thing? Listen to how he argues.
How do we know that?
Because we have Paul's letters.
How do we know he didn't lie about it?
Why would he lie about it?
Paul
says things about Jesus as off-the-cuff comments where he's not making a point. And, see, that's very important to historians. In other words, a historian wants to find disinterested comments.
Right.
And Paul has disinterested comments where he says things, for example, about James, the brother of the Lord, which is just an off-the-cuff comment because everybody that he's writing to knows who he's talking about. So he just makes the off-the-cuff comment. That's very important information. Mm-hmm.
And that is, if he wrote them.
Disciples. Now, comment about the 12 disciples? So the whole point is that you've got a disinterested comment from somebody who actually knew these people.
If he even wrote that, though, correct? Because isn't there some...
Well, there's no doubt about Paul writing Galatians.
Aren't there some theories that suggest that...
Okay, now, there's no doubt that Paul wrote Galatians. How do you demonstrate that? I mean, I agree there isn't any doubt that Paul wrote Galatians, but I think that there really isn't any meaningful, serious doubt that he wrote 1 Timothy either. And I know exactly how... Ehrman denies that the pastoral epistles were Pauline. You know, he'll try to say, well, you know, there's terms that are used in them that are not used as often in the other Pauline letters. But the fact is, if you isolated Galatians and set it against the other six, you could make a case that it isn't Pauline by using them as the standard. See, it's a very subjective thing. And he's bought into a very subjective thing. And so now he's getting challenged on the subjectivism of his position. And what's going to be fascinating is the form of argumentation he uses to substantiate.
Maybe Paul himself had scribe that wrote for him.
Well, every person who wrote epistles in the ancient world dictated them to scribes.
Right. So how do we know then that?
Well, how do you know Cicero wrote his letters?
I don't. I'm not a historian, so I don't know much about
right.
Cicero. But
no, I am a historian, and I'm telling you.
But there are some. but there are many historians who disagree with you, aren't
no.
they?
No, none that I've ever heard of.
Listen,
oh, really?
Listen.
Well, not serious historians.
Not serious historians.
Listen, I know thousands of scholars of the ancient world, and mm-hmm. I don't know any one of these scholars who doubts that Paul wrote Galatians.
Okay.
So these are people who have devoted their lives to this, and a lot of them mm-hmm. are like me. It's not that I've got a personal investment in Paul. I mean, I'm not even a Christian.
Right.
I'm just saying, as a historian, there's no doubt Paul wrote Galatians.
What was the basis of that? Because I'm a historian. This is the authority argument. And in just a moment, he's going to say, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I'm telling you, I'm a historian, believe me. That's the argument. The argument is, I know, I go to all the SBL meetings, and I go to all this stuff, and I meet with all these people, and I know who they are, and so I've been doing this for 30 years, so believe me, it's the argument from authority. He doesn't provide anything more than that. Now, maybe he... Now, one of the problems here is that he and the infidel guy are going back and forth, and part of the problem here is that the infidel guy already has a great investment in the scholarship of people like Robert Price, stuff like that, and he's wanting to get back to the historical Jesus stuff, and Ehrman just doesn't know this stuff that well. This isn't his area. And so he sometimes they sort of talk past each other. But I found it fascinating that his primary defense of his position was, well, believe me, I've been doing this for 30 years. I read this stuff in the original languages. Well, there have been people who read this stuff in the original language, did it for 50 years, that think Paul wrote all of those epistles. Does that make them right? Of course not. It's the argument from Thor. Doesn't wash, but it's fascinating to listen to.
Hmm. I'm right with you. He probably wrote some things. I'm just saying,
Paul
I'm
wrote some things.
Out, because as you conceded already, that we know that there has been embellishment, people adding things as...
Right, but see, you can't just take that and just assume that everything is an embellishment.
Mm.
You have to do the serious historical work and figure mm-hmm. out what's an embellishment and what's not. And that isn't just a matter of just guessing or...
I wasn't saying everything. I was just saying just be skeptical to that, too. That's all. I was just saying...
Well, absolutely you have to be skeptical about everything.
Right.
But once
right.
you approach it skeptically and you look at the...
But you are more skeptical than I am. Therefore, you're wrong. it does seem to be what we're hearing here.
You know, I've spent 30 years looking at this is what I do for a living. So it isn't mm-hmm. just kind of an off-the-cuff kind of comment. This is, I've been examining this evidence for 30 years, mm-hmm. reading this stuff in the original languages. So it's not like some crazy person who just wants to make money out of a book.
Now, I can tell the infidel guy really did not like this. He really did not like this because after Ehrman hangs up, he goes on. And he's like, I'm not into this authority stuff, man. When you start saying that everybody believes this, I'm just not into this stuff, man, and I'm sorry if this wasn't what you all were expecting. Well, I don't know what they're expecting, I guess. They expect as long as you aren't a Christian, then you're a Robert Price-level atheist or something, I guess. I don't know. But it was very interesting. You can just tell. He really chafed under this.
I mean,
right.
this is what I do for a living, and I can mm-hmm. just tell you that everybody who's looked at this thing seriously, there's nobody who doubts this.
Well, I wouldn't say nobody. It's just absolutely.
Now, if I use that kind of argumentation next week, would he buy it? If I said, everyone who's looked at this seriously agrees with me, is he going to buy that? Because what the infidel guy is going to do here is he can say, well, wait a minute. So you're saying the people who totally mythologize Paul or totally mythologize Jesus just aren't serious. Well, what's your definition of serious?
Somebody.
That's an absolute claim, though, isn't it? I mean,
name one New Testament scholar who doubts that Paul wrote Galatians.
Oh, no. I remember you keep going back to that. I didn't deny that he wrote Galatians. I think I agree at least twice so far. I agree with you. You probably could have, for all I know.
Wait a minute. I sort of got the feeling that he did deny that, didn't you? I think I sort of heard him saying things like, well, how do you know he wrote any of that, and blah, blah, blah. And now we're doing the backpedal thing here really fast, and the scary thing is there's a camera right on him, and all of his devoted followers are watching him. He could not have enjoyed this whatsoever.
Probably could have.
But I was saying, well, fine. But I'm simply saying, but actual content, how do we know that there aren't just complete lies or embellishments? And then you went back to, well, because he just said something off the cuff.
I'm agreeing that there are. But you have to know which things are the embellishments. It's not an embellishment
right.
that Paul met with James in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't, you know, you can systematically doubt anything, sure, but I mean, that's not how you do history. You do history by looking at evidence.
That needs to be turned into its own sound clip. Because obviously, one of the primary criticisms that has been made of Dr. Ehrman is, well, as Gordon Fee put it, he takes possibilities and turns them into probabilities, and then he takes probabilities and turns them into certainties. And that is exactly how that works, and there is an inconsistency there.
Right, right. What do you think about Dr. Bob Price? Dr. Bob Price is
right. Don't know.
You don't know Dr. Robert M. Price?
He's the guy who denies Jesus existed?
I think he's pretty much leaning more toward that, yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think he... he's not... I don't really know him, no.
Interesting.
Why would I?
He's a theologian as well. And
what books has he published?
You can look him up. He has too many to mention right now.
He's got lots of them. They're all from Prometheus, though.
Deconstructing Jesus. Have you heard that one? And
yeah, he's actually communicated with me, and he's told me some of his doubts, and I've been puzzled by it because I don't really understand. I haven't seen any evidence that he's adduced.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, I would suggest maybe you want to read some of this stuff, but again, I know you're so busy. If I read, it's just like me, I have 100 books on the shelf. I think I still haven't gotten a chance to read yet because I get books every week, but okay, but yeah, I mean, people are posting them all in a room, the Colossal Apostle, the Shrinking Son of Man, but as you know.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, Shrinking Son of Man. Yeah, all right, yeah.
Okay. That guy, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
There are some people who've been researching even longer than you have, and they also have, you know, doctors, double doctors. They've been researching this. Some, I think he's even a professor at a university.
No, he's not.
He was teaching at, what was he?
He doesn't have a teaching job.
I can't remember where he was. Well, he did or does. I can't remember now.
No, he doesn't.
I don't keep up with him right now, but but he was at some place instructing on, I can't remember now, but. Too bad he's not here. Maybe one of the fans will call him up and give us a call in here. But anyway, my point was, though, for me, I like to consider myself a pretty rational guy, and I try to stay away from absolutes as much as possible. Whenever someone says, nobody, this can't be, or this is impossible, or things like that,
I go. New Testament scholars I know, nobody doubts that Paul wrote Galatians. That's what I said. And that's not an absolute statement. I mean,
I'm sorry. I guess I misunderstood you. Earlier, it sounded like you didn't. It sounded like you kind of qualified it just now. But before, it just sounded like you said anybody. You just said nobody thinks this. Nobody thinks that.
Nobody of the thousands of scholars I know doubts it.
Right. Right. Okay. None of the ones you know. Granted.
And I know all the leading figures in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
I'm very active in the Society of Biblical Literature.
Right.
And I know all the professors in the major universities in the country who teach this.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, all right. There's also Hector Avalos. Somebody brings him up as well.
He's a colleague of mine.
Right. And he doubts it that
he
Jesus
doubts
existed.
What?
Well, somebody in chat said he doubts that Jesus existed.
Hector Avalos does.
Let me see. He said that...
Can you hear the laughter in his voice? He's hardly controlling himself.
Oh, well, he's not...
No, I don't think so.
I'm waiting for him to qualify with statements here. I'm waiting for him to give more information in here, but he's not giving us more information. But anyway...
Why would you think that Hector Alvarez doubts that Jesus existed?
Yeah, I'm waiting for him to
somebody
post
in the chat channel
here.
Said so. That's
you have Hector on the line?
What he said about the topic, the historicity of Jesus. Okay.
I tell you, that was fascinating. They eventually got back to, you know, back and forth stuff, and we'll listen to that too. But I want to get to our phone caller. But that was fascinating to me. It really, really was. To listen to Ehrman run into someone who is more radical than he is. And his response, the argumentation I got was, believe me, because I've been doing this for 30 years. That was the argumentation. I mean, you got to know what the additions are. Well, yeah, you do. That's true. I mean, you have to be able to make a case. You can't just simply go radical with it. But, you know, what are the foundations for making the kinds of conclusions that he's made? And when those are challenged, especially by someone way off to his left, he's not used to that. He's used to defending himself from the right, not from the left. And that was truly interesting. Anyway, I want to make sure that we can get to Gary here. And if we can get back to the program, depends on how long the question is. Let's talk to Gary. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello, Dr. White.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, sure. I have just finished reading through Lost Christianities by Dr. Ehrman.
Mm-hmm.
And he brings up the issue of 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 34 through 35.
Mm-hmm.
Let the women be silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak. And he brings forth several arguments why he doesn't believe that Paul originally wrote that. But to sum up, the major thrust of his argument is that he says in some of our manuscripts, which unfortunately he doesn't name, but he says in several of our manuscripts that we have that these two verses appear in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And so he theorizes that because of that might indicate to us that it appeared as a marginal note originally, and scribes would insert it where they judge best. And so given that, I was just kind of wondering what Christian scholarship has said, maybe in response or just by themselves, if they've addressed that issue.
It's interesting because when he first addresses this in an article called The Text as Window, The Text as Window, New Testament Manuscripts and a Social History of Early Christianity, which first appeared in 1995, he's not nearly as firm on that, but he has undergone a lot of change over time as far as asserting that the text is non-original. Actually, interestingly enough, one of the primary people that you will hear cited in defense of that position today is Gordon Fee. And in fact, again, Dan Wallace in his Evangelical Theological Society talk this past November specifically mentioned how Gordon Fee has, in essence, argued that against the biblical evidence. What is the biblical evidence? All the manuscripts contain the text. In DFG, a couple manuscripts of the Vulgate, in a couple citations of Ambrosiaster, the verses appear after verse 40. Instead of after verse 33. So DF and G this is only found in what's called the Western manuscripts. There's no foundation for this in the Alexandrian or Byzantine manuscripts. And generally, when a variant is only found within just one family, that's not necessarily a good thing in the sense of it having any originality. What's more is D is particularly idiosyncratic, as I'll be discussing next week in my discussion, my paper before the debate on the utilization of D as the foundation for the reading in Mark 1:41. But other than that, that is the only evidence that there is some Western witnesses, 5th century and beyond, that have a transposition there. And so while you can theorize that it was some sort of a marginal note, that's a rather odd marginal note, there are much earlier witnesses to the text of 1 Corinthians that contain this. The vast majority of manuscripts do, including the earlier witnesses that do. The interesting thing is that while Fee does make notice of that, his argumentation against the originality of the terms is primarily based upon the idea that these words are directly contradictory to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And therefore, since they're contradictory and you have that slight textual issue, then he jettisons them on that basis. And Wallace takes him to task for that in his talk. And if you're interested, I linked to an offering of the DVDs of Dan Wallace's talk about a week and a half ago to 2 weeks ago on my blog. So if you'll just do a search on the blog for Dan Wallace, it should pull it up, and I would encourage folks to get hold of that, because it was excellent information, and there is a whole discussion, well, as much of a discussion as you get into in an ETS presentation, of Dan's concern about the argumentation that Gordon Fee used at that point.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you very much, Dr. White. Yeah, that pretty much sums up, yeah, the argumentation he uses, especially, yeah, like you mentioned, the he mentions his other arguments seem to be that it kind of interrupts the flow, and once it's taken out, everything is
there's one major problem with that, and that is you go almost anywhere in Paul, and you could make an argument against texts that are clearly original. There's no textual issue with them whatsoever, but sometimes Paul just all of a sudden goes someplace else for a while. I mean, look at Romans, and when there's a whole section inserted, then you come back to the argument. So, I mean, I really get concerned when people use that kind of argumentation willy-nilly, especially when you are what you're seeing. What we need to understand today is what you're seeing in Ehrman, Epp, and Parker, D.C. Parker out of England. Is a postmodernist movement away from a concern about the establishment of the original text to a higher emphasis upon what the variants themselves can tell you. And so what Ehrman is saying and what others are saying is, well, this is reflective of the early anti-woman attitude developing in Christianity. And so entire, you know, books are now being written on where you're exegeting the variant rather than attempting to establish the original words. There are people like D.C. Parker who said, we don't need the original words. We have the tradition, see? And so, you know, just a total overthrow of the Reformation principles and things like that. And they're bringing a lot of extraneous stuff in. And so a lot of people still read them as if they're just doing text critical stuff, but they're not. They're putting a lot of emphasis upon the nature of the variants. And my biggest problem with that is, and this is one of my main problems with Ehrman's approach in toto, is you can't mind read scribes. You can theorize until the cows come home that, well, you know, this was developing that time. Maybe that influenced him. Maybe. But I know people today who really seem to be completely untouched by the world going by around them. And so if they were copying stuff from the New Testament, there might be great theological battles going on around them. They wouldn't know it. They're in their own world. How do you know that scribe wasn't like that? You can't mind read ancient scribes in the way that modern scholars would like to. You can publish lots of papers where you theorize about stuff, but what good really is that in the final analysis other than the number of trees that get killed in the process? Sorry, Katie. So, that's just something else to keep in mind. Okay?
Right.
All right.
Thank you very much, Dr. White.
Thank you for your call. God bless.
Okay, God bless.
Bye-bye. All right, one more dividing line before we head off to Florida, and we will attempt to arrange some dividing lines while I am gone. Certainly a debate report would be in line, obviously. We'll do our best, even though Thursday is going to be really rough to try to do something like that, but we'll see what we can work out. But this Thursday, we'll still be here. We might be able to wrap up the Infidel Guy Bart Ehrman program and so on and so forth. I obviously very focused upon what's going on, hoping that you're praying for next week, because I think it could be a tremendously useful encounter for the body of Christ. We'll see you on Thursday. God bless. Contend for the faith the Father's fought for.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.